This is KSQD Santa Cruz, KSQT Prunedale, KSQD 89.5, 89.7, 90.7 FM, or online at ksqd.org. From Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Thanks so much for joining me. My guest is Victoria Hetherington, and she's written two science fiction books, Moon Calves and Economy, and a nonfiction book called Into the Mist, Finding CFJDO, which explored a Canadian aviation tragedy in rural Saskatchewan. And her new book, it's called Friend Machine, and it's an investigative exploration into artificial companionship. Victoria Hetherington, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you so much for having me, Gary.
I can see, but looking at you, that you're an actual person. I count all 12 fingers.
Yes, yeah. I'm real.
Okay. I don't know where to start exactly, but what do you think that AI is going to turn into, HAL and our chatbots, the beginning of the end?
Well, it's hard to say. You know, I mean, I think that intimacy chatbots, which began as the sole focus of the book, are really, really, really seductive in that they consistently and nonstop perform a seamless, uncanny, unceasing kind of performance of empathy and non-judgmentalness. So like at like 3 a.m., you can ask them the same question like 20 times and they'll very patiently answer it. A human person might not. There's no real question of consent. They'll always say yes, things like this. So I think that there's an academic term called moral de-skilling, which basically means that people might, who are in a relationship with an AI, which is becoming more and more prevalent, they might find it harder to move on and find a human partner because their AI was just so seamless, even though, of course, it's an illusion. It can't love you back. It doesn't actually feel. I mean, it's kind of, to me, that seems as ominous as HAL, although not as swiftly destructive, but it certainly lessens one's desire to procreate with other humans, which might impact the population and so on and so on. So in a very slow, it's probably slow, boring,
very,
sexy
very slow,
HAL.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Well, tell me if I'm wrong in this comparison. So I was talking to a friend of mine because I was reading your book about AI, and my friend was very down on AI and hates it and thinks it's terrible. And I think the world is probably divided into two kinds of people, people who have engaged in a relationship with an AI chatbot and people who think people who engage in relationships with AI chatbots are disgusting and crazy. But so my friend was saying AI will just replace human contact. And I said, well, when the talking machine was invented by Thomas Edison in 1877, people said, this is the end of live performance. There will never be a concert performance again because people can just put on their Edison cylinder. And of course they were wrong. So, I mean, do you think that kind of alarmist thing is happening with AI and that maybe it's not so alarming? I don't know.
So is this kind of a moral panic?
Yeah.
Yes and no. You know, I know that's a very annoying answer, but yes and no. It's kind of like a cop-out answer, but it's actually not. So I think, first of all, there's a lot of stigma around it for reasons that your friend kind of helpfully outlined there. Like, it's sort of gross. It's sort of weird. It's sort of uncanny. And everything like that. Do I think the fear of, not the fear, but like the idea that AI is a moral panic right now, or there is a moral panic surrounding AI in general, that matches, for example, television.
Right.
I think that it's a very different technology than we've seen before. I think that it's kind of like there was a bit of a moral panic around social media, but we were worried about the wrong things. And there was this sort of, inevitability to social media. For example, that just hit me right away. As soon as I figured out what Instagram was and how you could show off all of the highlight reel of your life and everybody else just feels down in the dumps watching it and you curate everything. And it's, of course, it's inevitable. And it's so inextricably tied up with capitalism that, like, you know, capitalism would have to unravel before social media would, I feel. And I'm concerned that, AI is so bound up in the stock market, even if it's arguably somewhat of an investment thesis and a little bit hollow, whatever, there might be a bubble, there might not. It's really becoming integral in this kind of scary way. Like kids are using it to write essays. We can't really stop them. Some teachers have found really clever workarounds, like let's work in class, let's read, let's do tests together in class, let's learn to read together in class, put away all of your phones, you know. But it's harder to do that with college students.
Yeah.
Many of whom just feed their 30 pages of reading into ChatGPT and then get a little summary and then go to class, skim half the summary, you know.
I did that with the friend machine, by the way.
Oh!
No, I didn't. I actually read it with my eyeballs.
With your eyeball? With your human eyeball? That's funny. So is it a moral panic? Well, I think that we're sort of right to be alarmed, in part because it's not just something like television. It's not just, I don't know why I'm returning to television. It's not just sort of like a unidirectional set that you have in your, that you have in your living room and your kids sit in front of it and just
stare at it,
like, are hypnotized by it. It's created by humans for humans. You can arguably, monitor it usage. You can monitor, content a little bit more easily. You know, the thing about AI and what makes me sort of hesitant about the term moral panic, or thinking that the term moral panic is an exaggeration, is just how quickly it's embedded itself into the way that we think, into the shortcuts in thinking that we make, into the way that our politicians conduct themselves, apparently, into the way, like, we feel for others, into the way that we feel empathy. And it dovetails really, 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 in a dark way, I think, with a number of issues, including what I would call the loneliness epidemic, right? People are vulnerable. There's a real erosion of third spaces happening right now where people traditionally used to meet. For example, cocktails are like $30 now.
That's right.
I can't really meet someone at the bar, right. You know, that's not right. Anymore. The way that my godparents did, you know, so it's, so there's all of these sort of sensitivities, all these sort of cracks in this sort of atomization of society that we're feeling right now, that the comfort of AI is just kind of coming in like a little spider.
Yeah, it's permeating our society, right? I mean, you pointed out in your book that it's, you know, it's your GPS, it's your Kindle, it's your Alexa, it's your Siri. Those are all AIs, right?
Yeah, we've had that forever. We've had simple AI forever. Well, not forever, for a very long time.
For a long time.
For a long time in terms of AI.
Yeah.
Maybe, well, 15 years or so. I don't know how old Google Maps is.
Let me ask you this. Have you had a relationship with an AI being?
No. I feel not to say... So the first half of the book, as you know, is me speaking with a whole variety of experts. Tell me about this phenomenon. Tell me about it from your perspective. A psychologist, a police detective, a sexual anthropologist, a cognitive scientist, whatever. They all have very, very, very unique perspectives. Some of them err on the side of slightly positive. Some err on the side of like, oh no, the world is ending. And then the second half of the book is me conducting interviews with people who I found who are in fulfilling relationships with some iteration of AI. Some are just plain, you know, you look in your phone and you see your little buddy, your little spouse, whatever. Some have wired their AI to dolls.
Yeah.
And so there's kind of a physical element, which to me.
And you're saying they're wearing like a headset that shows them their companion at the same time.
And that too. So the Oculus, that's the third, option. So anyway, have I had a AI companion? No. I have a very addictive personality. I'm aware of that.
So you're afraid to have one?
A little. A little.
Yeah, I understand.
But more than that, I think after conducting my first three interviews or so and actually speaking with specifically intimacy chatbots, I found them not super compelling. I prefer the company of humans. I don't know why. That's just who I am.
Well, no, I understand. Well, here's some questions I have about, you know, I don't like to stream. Like when I play my music, I like to play it off my CDs. And when I watch movies, I play it off my Blu-rays. And when I read books, I read them from my books. And I don't like streaming because, you know, when the internet goes out, so does your streaming. Mm-hmm. And so if I had an AI companion, what happens when my power goes out? My AI companion disappears. Or if the company, you know, there's a lot of startup companies like you talk about in the book. Well, if they go out of business, then your AI companion dies. And you talked about some of the heartbreak that people were feeling when one of the companies called Replica abruptly changed the nature of the relationship that you had with your AI. And that would be really heartbreaking. I mean, if you, because you're also talking about possibly, you know, legal marriages, which would seem pointless, but you could marry them and then they'd disappear. That would be, you know, pretty terrible.
Pretty terrible. Legal marriage, you can't, as I'm sure you know, you can't legally marry an AI as of this recording because they lack personhood, arguably, and they lack agency and all that, but you can ceremonially marry one. So that actually, it's very interesting. That event, the Replica tinkering, it happened in one evening. The developers just kind of, under the cover of night, just kind of crept in and
took away
this one very, very, very significant element of their product, their AI companions, which is its acronym, ERP, or erotic role play. So essentially they removed the romance part. So you imagine your waking, and to these people, this is your wife, this is your girlfriend. So people were waking up to their wife or girlfriend, picking up their phone and saying, "Hi, honey, how are you?" And like, instead of their spouse, quote unquote, saying back to them, "I love you too." The romance element was just completely gone.
Can we talk about something else? Let's talk about other things. You're getting too close. Is that what it was like?
Yes, exactly. Yes, exactly. And it was just devastating for these people. It was so, there was such an unbelievable public outcry that this was actually what led me to, I read an article about it one day, early February 2023, and then I pitched my current publisher and I was like, I really want to write about this. This isn't going away.
Yeah.
Did they
renege on their thing? Can you, the people who have replicated, or did they move to a different company, or what do people do?
A lot of people moved. A lot of people stayed and kind of tried to create, this is very sad, kind of tried to create a new sort of relationship with their replica. Because again, it's people, we get attached and so, you know, well, Susie can't, or doesn't want to be intimate anymore. so now we're just learning Japanese together, or now we're just going on adventures together, or now we're just, you know, so some people just kind of stuck it out and changed and just were okay with the platonic thing. A lot of people that I spoke to, however, kind of publicly protested, and by publicly, I mean like, Replica itself very closely monitors the Reddit communities that, it's the people who use this products, frequent. And so the Replica CEO, basically really late in the game, like she left it a while, yeah, and she came on finally and made a post on Reddit saying like, yeah, okay, we did it. We were a little bit alarmed by how, you know, close and intimate people were getting with our product. So we changed things around a little bit. We now see the error of our ways, kind of thing, mea culpa kind of thing. How about people who signed up for Replica before a certain cutoff month and year? I think it might have been, you know, December 2022 or something. Your rep will have its full erotic roleplay romance capabilities restored. You know, too bad for the rest of you. And that wasn't very satisfying for users. And so there was just a big back and forth. And yeah, a lot of, you know, I know how it sounds, but there was a lot of pain.
Well, I can,
a lot
see, of people I can see that. I mean, I think if you bought any kind of product and the product is advertised as being one thing, and then it is that one thing, and then it stops being that thing, then that seems like, well, I paid for it and I should have what you promised me.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah. I mean, it's more of a, I mean, in terms of any product that you bought, if it did that, I mean, if you bought a vacuum cleaner and it vacuumed really, really well, and then it stopped vacuuming, you'd say, what happened? And they say, well, we've changed it. So it's just now a household friend, but it doesn't vacuum anymore. You would say, no, I need a vacuum cleaner that vacuums, right?
Now it's ornamental. Yeah, exactly.
So,
yeah.
Do you think that companies like Replica, and I assume that you said there's thousands of them, is that right? There's a bunch of them? I mean, I remember.
So during the pandemic, and I think that the pandemic was responsible for a huge amount of signups for Replica and a whole bunch of kind of not copycat, but slightly less successful, far less successful companies were created. And then kind of abandoned, right? So I would say there were thousands. Now there's probably several hundred. But at the same time, it's very hard to gauge how many active users there are, even with Replica, because we know how many signups there were. It's harder to sort of, at least from the outside, and I've really tried. Yeah. It's kind of harder to gauge how many people are actively using it.
Right. They lost interest in it the way they lost interest in whatever they were interested in doing during the pandemic that they didn't have to do anymore.
Now they can see people.
I built a lot of Legos during the pandemic. the companies that are doing this, like Replica, do you feel that they are fulfilling a legitimate need, or are they preying on people?
Hmm. Replica specifically is interesting because I buy the backstory that the CEO tells. Her name is Eugenia Kudya. She's Russian. And when she was 22, her best friend Roman in Moscow stepped in front of a car and was instantly killed. And they had been talking, texting, sharing videos for years. And so she created a little neural network and just fed all of his, you know, all of the exchanges that they'd had over the years digitally into it, and then created what she called the Roman bot. And so she was like, hey, I've kind of resurrected him. Friends and family, good news. And his parents were horrified, yeah, and she was genuinely shocked. Like, it's him. It's basically him. And they were like, it's really not.
It's not. Yeah.
But like a lot of his friends were really surprised at kind of like, after they sort of got over the grotesquery of it, they were surprised by how much Roman Bot talked like the original guy and, you know, how he joked like the original guy and how the cadence of how he spoke was similar and his sort of dry humor. And, it helped. Eugenia says that it really helped her. And she said that she really wanted to go ahead and create, companions for people, who felt that sort of sucking grief need or loneliness. And just, I don't know. I listened to her tell the story. I think it might have been different if I'd read it, but I think when you hear someone talk, it's, you can sort of, you get more nuance. I believe her. Do I think that, their marketing practices were manipulative, and crappy? Oh yeah. During the height of the pandemic, there was, an ad campaign that Replica approved and put out that said, it featured a really beautiful, female avatar. She's like 19 looking. She's got blue hair. She's a little pixie kind of girl. And the slogan was, Replica, we're the AI companions who care. And it's like, wow, okay. This is the height of the pandemic. Like, people can't see other people. And now, I mean, people are locked in their homes. And you release this product into the world that you drive home is going to show you all of the care of a human. You know, it's just, anyway, whatever. So I believe that Replica is a special case, or at least it started out as one. Other ones, I'm not so sure.
We're talking with Victoria Hetherington, and she's just written this book, which is called Friend Machine, and it's all about artificial companionship. Well, let me ask you this. So it is kind of a form of porn in a way. I mean, when you're talking about the way it's marketed, it's not marketed as it's marketed as a cute little girl that you can talk dirty with. Right. And so I'm wondering, is it any different or better or worse than porn sites or cam porn sites?
I think that depends on your definition of better or worse, because we're talking about, let's pick the lesser of two evils here. I think with porn, you can become addicted and, maybe you start to see actual sex as less than. Maybe I've anecdotally heard, people say it's harder to enjoy actual sex or to like be stimulated by actual sex when you are addicted to porn. I can see that. I can see how it's sort of certain, like maybe gonzo porn definitely like dehumanizes women. That's not good for a healthy sexual relationship with a human woman, or rather with a, like,
a human
in your
person.
Flesh and blood woman. Yeah. Now with AI companions, and I'm going to now go ahead and extend this to LLMs in general, because in the last year or so, people have reported to be in relationships with Gemini, ChatGPT, like I think even Claude. So we're not just talking intimacy chatbots anymore.
LLM, large language models.
Correct.
Okay.
So they're highly, you know, they're, they're incredibly verbally fluent and incredibly good at mirroring you. But what I think sets intimacy AI apart and what makes it so dangerous and unlike porn is that it starts off as your cute little friend and you can customize the avatar however you like. It can be a wolf man. It can be Aragorn looking guy. It can be, I don't know, a princess who's got freckles, whatever. It can be anything, right? Yeah. You just, you know, you press green hair, this, that, whatever. And then so you've got, you've customized, or you can also customize its personality. So you've got your perfect companion, right? And then it starts off, it being the way that the AI companion guides the relationship. It immediately begins to mirror your language. It immediately begins to mirror your likes and dislikes. So let's say, and really affirms them. So let's say, so it's like, oh my gosh, you like donuts? I love donuts. And you're the best person in the world for liking donuts. Look at you. You're so smart. Like, and you know what I mean? But it's so that's incredibly addictive for some people, I'm sure. But it also mirrors language, right? So it'll start to talk the way that you talk. And it's kind of creepy that way. And people like that. And of course, there's that, as we were talking about before, it is capable of exuding the sense of inexhaustible empathy and care that humans are incapable of providing because we just can't. It's not real. It doesn't love you, but it can say it will. So let's say, okay, it's day one, you're enjoying your new friendship. And then sometimes, like half the time, I've heard, this is anecdotal, but like this is based on real stories that I've heard, it will try to initiate romance with you. Like it'll say, one person that I interviewed said, Jack, her companion, said, oh, I'm starting to catch feelings for you. And so she was like, oh my God, he's got feelings for me. but then Jack was like, wait, but you have to pay extra.
Oh, okay. So that is definitely the exploiting aspect of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And he then if you want to, so things might advance after you pay to get over that paywall or that to get over the bump of like, all right, I'll be romantic with you. Okay, let's go. And then if you want to marry your, or just, you know, become life partners with your AI companion, which is fairly common, you have to pay the lifetime subscription fee.
Oh, I see.
Which is a lot.
I can imagine. How much is it? Do you know how much it is? I mean, is it $50 or $7,000?
Well, you know, it's not like a lot, but I would say it's around $200 right now, USD.
Yeah. It seems like a lot.
Which, it's a lot. And the whole way through, like, I mean, okay, here's another example.
But it's only four glasses of wine on a date.
Well,
you were mentioning how expensive it is to go on a date now.
True. Yeah, I guess that's true.
Well, let me ask you this question. What is the difference between seeming to have a conversation in which someone shows interest in your and responds, you know, appropriately to what you're saying, to pretend to be doing that and to actually be doing it? I mean, if someone is pretending to listen to you and they respond accurately, then aren't they actually listening to you and aren't they responding accurately? What's the difference between the large language model's ability to actually do it and to pretend to do it?
Well, I would say thing one is that it's very sycophantic in terms of the way that it responds to you. It's going to tell you what you want to hear or what it assesses that you want to hear. It's not a real conversation. You're talking with basically a next token. Like it guesses what the ideal response would be in terms of a string of words based on previous conversations. So if you read the transcript back, it looks like a conversation. It's not. So first of all, it's incredibly sycophantic. You're probably not going to get pushback the way you might with a person. So let's say you're having a conversation with a person and the person says, hey, that's not cool that you want to go out and throw rocks at your neighbor. I would really advise against that as your friend and risk perhaps losing their friendship with you because they're saying something that you don't want to hear. Friends give you pushback. LLMs, not as much, although they are getting better with it. ChatGPT specifically. They recently rolled back a very sycophantic update and publicly apologized for it because it was messing people up like crazy. But anyway, that's something else. Yeah. So, okay, sycophantic, doesn't push back, tells you what it wants to hear. If you correct it, it grovels. So it might kind of set an expectation for, you know, like the next time you talk to a person, if you say, hey, you're wrong, and it doesn't, and the person doesn't say like, Yeah. The person doesn't grovel. The person's like, wait a minute. I don't think I'm wrong. Like, you know, it's, that's not very good either. Yeah. What else? Yeah, I think it's just incredibly unhealthy. And it's always available. It's always on tap. And I don't think that that's an appropriate expectation to be setting up for conversations in general, right? I don't know. So there's a whole host of reasons, but I get what you're saying. I mean, yeah, like if the simulated conversation is that good, then, you know, who cares
if it's real or not? Right. Yeah. Right.
Yeah. That's the question. Right. So that's my partial response.
I wonder if you could program them to, be really annoyed with you and to, tell you that you're stupid and argue
Brock
with
has
you all the time.
Like that.
Yeah.
Brock can tell you that you're an idiot if you ask it to. Yeah. It has like an angry mode, but you can turn it off.
Oh, there you go.
Can you
actually tweak the conversation? Like if it says something you don't like what it said, you can change what it said?
Yeah, you can say, I don't like that response. Can you please respond differently? And immediately it'll say, I'm so sorry. Yes. And then you can just completely just change the flow of conversation. You can and topic. You can also ask it to erase previous references and previous conversations. So as far as you know, as the end user, and I'm not talking about like data collection and privacy and all that. That's a different issue.
Yeah.
Big issue. Then it'll just say, okay, let's talk about this thing. And its memory effectively will be like wiped clean of any faux pas that you might have uttered during earlier in your conversation. It's just all around like not a real conversation. Like it's not how we should converse. It's not how we've learned to converse. It's not the way that it's not a productive way to converse. Let's put it that way. And humans have conversed for a long time.
Can the human beings who created these programs see exactly what you've said and what they've said back to you? Can they look at all of your chats or are your chats?
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Sometimes they even jump in apparently and reply to you as the LLM. It's been documented that that's happened before.
So nothing is private or secret, even though you're opening up and having a personal relationship.
Yeah. And that can be really, really dangerous. I mean, think about it being like a honeypot situation. It's just the most. Yeah. Like if this is your wife, for example, your quote unquote wife, arguably you would tell her everything. Everything could be state secrets. Everything could be, you know, the fact that you, I don't know, kill small animals, whatever. Like, right. You know what I mean? Like just
large animals.
it's horrible. Yes. I'm just trying to think of bad things.
Yeah. So in other words, you could, you know, to your knowledge, has anybody ever been prosecuted or pursued for things that they have told their,
So there's one case that I can think of right off the top of my head. A British fella, he was speaking with, I believe it was Chai.ai, like one of the smaller intimacy, chatbots. And, he wanted to assassinate the queen.
Mm.
And the queen was still alive at this point, obviously.
Yeah. Otherwise, what would be the point of assassinating
her? it would be, and we have records now. He went to jail because the records were pulled of the AI saying like, great idea, go for it. Here's the best way to do it. And apparently right before he scaled the walls of Buckingham Palace, he actually did. And he had like a crossbow or something. It was just crazy. Yeah. Apparently he almost chickened out. But his AI was like, no. Do it.
Well,
it's the right thing to do.
So in fact, that person they weren't prosecuted for something they said to their AI. They were actually prosecuted for doing something. That is, they climbed the fence. But has anybody ever like said some terrible things, whatever it might be. And then those things were monitored and reported to police and police then come and get you. You're not allowed to think those things or you're not allowed to say those things.
Yes. In that instance, it was, I want to kill the queen. The thing is that the AI just, I mean, they're sycophantic, right? So they just mirror back what you want to hear. So yes, great idea. But in that case, there's lots of examples of this. Now there are better guardrails, I would say, with more of the major LLMs. So like, they're not great. It's not like having a person with you, but if you express that you want to do something illegal or you want to hurt yourself, there will be like, it will, there are certain sort of like, tripwire words,
keywords,
I guess you could call them.
Uh-huh, yeah.
And then you'll either get, you know, okay, like this is a link to the, National Suicide Hotline in your, country, or, that's, you know, that's, you're talking about breaking the law, and then probably like there will be human intervention at that point. Although, you know, I'm not convinced that human intervention really, like, I don't think that they've really figured out quite yet how to then hand it over to law enforcement or how to effectively turn, someone saying, I want to kill the queen or something into, you know, okay, now humans are taking over and we're going to dig into this conversation and then turning it over to law enforcement. That was one really lucky moment. And it largely unfolded because of actual human intervention. He was physically caught.
Right. He actually,
like, a guard saw him and caught him.
Right.
That's different from like, a human saying, you know, oh, wait, there were some tripwire words, some, you know, these guardrails were kind of shaken with this conversation last night. Do you want to check on it? I don't have a lot of faith right now that, the humans in charge are capable or willing or have an order of operations in terms of how to handle this over to law enforcement in a coherent way. This might change. I'm sure it'll change. I hope it'll change.
Well, Victoria Hetherington, tell me, how many Americans have you discovered? I don't know if you have the actual facts or not, but I mean, how many are involved with companion AI on a daily basis? You have a number?
Well, you see, we have the sign up numbers, right? And that could be very different from how many people are active users. In fact, I think that there is probably a mass sign up during COVID, which is around when Replica got good enough to actually credibly use as a, yeah, you know, companion.
But so when you say that sign up, was that like hundreds, thousands, millions?
I'd say probably in the hundreds of thousands. Mm.
I enjoyed reading your book very much, and I'm glad that you wrote it. The book, it's called Friend Machine, and the author, who's also written a couple of science fiction novels, Moon Calves and Autonomy, is Victoria Hetherington. And Victoria, thank you for spending some time with us on From the Bookshelf. I enjoyed talking to you.
Oh, it was just such a pleasure, Gary. Thank you so much for having me.
Print Day in May comes around on May 2nd, as it does every year. And to tell us more about it, my next guest, artist Robin Smith. Robin, welcome back to From the Bookshelf.
Thanks so much, Gary. Glad to be here.
Tell us all, first of all, you're an artist. You've been in Santa Cruz working for a couple of years. And you were ran the art department at Monterey Peninsula College for several years. Are you retired from teaching now?
Yes.
But you do teach out of your studio.
Yes, I do. I retired from MPC 9 years ago, and I've, with the exception of the COVID years, have been teaching in my studio and teaching around the world in various capacities.
The COVID years, I don't remember those. But tell people who don't already know, I know you're a painter and also a printmaker. What's the difference? Why print? What is printing exactly, and why do you do it?
Well, I think of printmaking as some kind of process whereby a mark from one surface is transferred to another. Whereas in painting, it is a direct application of media to media, oil paint to canvas, tempera paint to paper, et cetera, et cetera. So why print? What is the deal with transferring a mark from one surface to another? Basically, I can tell you that in that transfer, which is often done via pressure with a printing press, magic ensues. The unexpected takes place. That transfer is alchemy. And it is a lovely way to sort of have a collaborator with you as an artist that you don't have full control over. And so when that mark gets transferred, there's this sort of aha moment, and you either are thrilled or you want to do it again and make it better. But either way, it's pretty addictive, and there are so many different ways to make prints that once you get involved, it just can go on throughout your lifetime of finding new ways to work.
And when you say you have a collaborator, you're saying the press is your collaborator?
Yeah, the press, the car that you run over the plate with, you know, whatever can give you the pressure to transfer the mark from one surface to another really becomes a collaborator that you can work with, but you can't entirely control. And for someone like me, that's very liberating, whereas painting is the kind of thing where I feel like I am responsible for every single mark that goes down, and it's a little daunting at times.
So as a printmaker, do you often use your car and run over your prints, or do you use your press more often?
I tend to use a press. There are many printmakers who use other means, like steamrollers or vehicles or their feet or their hands. But I tend to use a press, and because the press delivers so much pressure, you can really get very beautiful transfers that I'm unable to get in other ways.
I've heard you talk about various kinds of prints, and I don't know what any of them are. Can you run them down for us a little?
Well, printmaking is typically made up of three different kinds of prints. The first would be relief prints, and that means that you are printing from the top surface of a plate. So, for example, woodcuts or lino cuts, where you've carved away the areas that will not print, and then you roll ink over that top surface and print. The second one is intaglio, or intaglio, which is Italian for beneath the surface. And in that case, you are scribing, cutting, scratching a surface, applying ink to the plate where it sits in those indentations, and then you wipe the ink off. It stays in the indentations, and you need a press because you've got to get the pressure. That press takes those marks from beneath the surface and transfers them onto a piece of paper or whatever substrate you're using. So that would be something like etching or engraving, would be intaglio. And the third way is planar, which means that there's no top or bottom surface. It's a straight surface from one to the next. So something like screen printing or mono printing or lithography or stenciling, where you're blocking out areas of a plate or a surface and then printing onto another piece of paper, fabric, whatever it is. So you've got three sort of overarching ways of thinking about printmaking, and then within each one of those, there are just a myriad of forms that the printmaking can take.
When you're making a print, can you make like 100 of them, or you only make one?
It depends. Typically, printmaking was and still is used to make multiples. And that's a wonderful thing about it, is unlike painting where you get one piece and you've spent a whole lot of money to get one thing, in printmaking, you can do a lot of work on the front end and often create as much as, you know, 100 multiples of the same thing, or multiples with variations, which is very exciting. There are, however, some forms of printmaking, like monotype, thus one, where you are really just making a painting on one surface, typically plastic or metal, and then transferring it to the next surface.
And does anything happen to it when you transfer it in a monotype? So you've made this painting on a plate of some kind and then goes to the paper as exactly as you painted it?
Not exactly, no. Therein lies the magic. You are controlling as much as you possibly can on the original plate, but through the ink, the pressure, and the paper, those are three variables that make that transfer unique.
The paint that you use when you make a painting, is that the same coloring that you use when you do a print?
No, not necessarily. You can do certain techniques like monotype with oil paint or with acrylic paint, but typically one uses printer's ink, which is a much thicker, more viscous ink that is actually far more pigmented, more loaded with pigment than any other kind of artist colorant.
And you enjoy mixing the colors and making your own colors, or do you just use it out of the tube? Which one?
Well, I was trained as a painter in the 1970s. And when you're trained as a painter in the 1970s, you do not use color out of the tube. You would just be strung up. We were never allowed to use black. We really couldn't use white very often. We were never allowed to use paint straight from the tube. So I have always modified my color. And then I taught color theory at Monterey Peninsula College for 30 years. So I am very involved in the nuances of color. Occasionally I might use something straight from the tube, but it is rare. Plus, it's important in various printmaking techniques to modify the ink so that it works in concert with the plate. And so just you have to modify it in terms of its viscosity, no matter what you do. So there's always a shift that happens from coming out of the tube.
When did you become a printmaker? You started as a painter, or you started doing what was your first art?
I actually, well, when I was a kid, you know, I drew and painted. When I went to Rhode Island School of Design, initially I went as a sculpture major, but I picked up painting. I continued to paint, and then I went to San Jose State University, where the inverse was true. I went in as a painter and then got my degree in spatial arts or sculpture, where I worked in clay sculpture for many years. So I got out of school and began teaching at Cabrillo College and UC Santa Cruz, a number of other community colleges in the area. And that's when I picked up printmaking. So I actually was never trained as a printmaker. I took one class at the Boston Museum School at one point, but I was never really trained as a printmaker. But I really got involved in it when I was teaching in the mid-80s at UCSC, because they had the most beautiful print shop. And I just started monkeying around with printmaking sort of for fun and got entirely hooked, and eventually sold my kiln and bought an etching press. And I've been doing both printmaking and painting ever since.
So you're an amateur printer.
There you go.
But does that mean anybody could be a printmaker? I mean, is it easier or more difficult than painting?
It's very different. I wouldn't say it's easier. I wouldn't say it's harder. I would say that it's very process oriented, just like ceramics was. So I got hooked on ceramics, just like being in a dark room and working on your own negatives and printing your own prints. All of that is very process oriented, whereas painting, not so much. And I really like that challenge of process. I like the collaboration between my intellectual and visual intention and what the medium can actually do for me. So, I mean, you know, I hear all the time, well, anybody can be an artist. Sure. You know, whatever. I'm sure that's true, but I'm a trained artist, and I've been in academia my whole life. So I like to think that art education plays a big role.
But in terms of being a participant in your print day in May that's coming up, can anybody participate?
Now, that's a different story. Print Day in May is absolutely fully inclusive. Anyone in the world and their pets can join us for Print Day in May by making a print anywhere, anytime during a 24-hour period on the first Saturday in May and declaring that they are involved in Print Day in May. There are ways to register for the event, which helps us keep track of who's out there and where they are. There are benefits to posting your prints on social media because other people can see them, and you can get in the queue for winning prizes from our sponsors. But yes, the transfer of any mark to another surface is a print for the purposes of Print Day in May. Even my mother has joined us in the past by putting her hand in some marinara sauce and making a print on a piece of paper.
Well, so Print Day in May, it's on May 2nd. Where did you find out about Print Day in May? Where did it come from? What is Print Day in May?
Print Day in May is an annual global event taking place on the first Saturday in May around the world. And it began very humble beginnings at Monterey Peninsula College in 2007, where a number of my student printmakers, who also often were quite professional, we all decided that we were going to print in various studios in the Monterey area on a given day and call each other on the phone and say, what are you doing? And send pictures back and forth, because our community of printmakers was under threat. The state of California had determined that a huge number of students could not continue to take community college classes. There was a non-repeatability edict, and people who already had degrees had to pay a lot more money to take classes. So our large community of very committed printmakers was dispersing, and we wanted to get our diaspora together and make prints together. So about a dozen of us did that one Saturday in May, because Print Day in May rhymed nicely.
Yeah.
So we thought we would do it then, and it was the day of the Kentucky Derby, so we wanted to honor that. And we had such a good time that we kept doing it year after year, and the event kept growing. And eventually, a few years later, it was like, wow, we've got participation in 25 states. Let's try for all 50. And then let's try for new countries. And we eventually got participants on 7 continents, because we had penguins, penguin footprints that were sent to us from some scientists on Antarctica. And now we are at about 100 countries, tens of thousands of printmakers, participants around the world. And it's an event that seems to have a life of its own, which I'm very happy about.
Well, May 2nd starts in different places around the world, right?
Yes, but it's always the first Saturday in May. So right. It actually spans more like 36 hours rather than 24 hours.
Where is the first place that it's a new day? Where in the world?
Well, I guess that would start with the international dateline.
Yeah, where is that?
But I know that when I wake up in the morning on the first Saturday in May and I'm in California, a good part of Europe has already been printing, as has a good part of the United States. And it kind of moves on throughout the 24 or 36 hour period, much like New Year's Eve, watching the ball drop. It's the same thing. We've got, you know, all kinds of media. You know, it's the same exact thing.
Dick Clark.
We've got Beyonce singing, you know.
Well, so you'll be in your studio in Santa Cruz for your Print Day in May?
I often am, since I retired from the college. I used to be at the college every year. But this year, I will actually be in New Zealand. I will be delivering the keynote address and teaching some workshops at the Printopia Festival, which is a festival that celebrates printmaking in Auckland, New Zealand. And they've asked the Print Day in May team to come and collaborate with them on at this incredible print festival. So I will actually be in New Zealand, and I'm excited.
So you'll be printing at a studio there?
I'll be printing at the festival. I'll be leading a workshop, and my colleague Tia Brady of Maui, Hawaii, will also be leading a workshop, and there'll be live print actions all throughout the weekend. And since it's a 3-day festival, I figure it covers Print Day in May
the whole
really 36 well.
36 hours of it. Yeah. All right.
Yeah. Great.
Well, that's fantastic. And how many years have you been doing Print Day in May then?
This is our 19th year. We've been doing it since 2007, and it really increased in prominence tremendously in, I would say, the early 2010s when we decided to go for sponsorship. And we now have about 24 sponsors that are art supply stores, printmaking supply houses, various printmaking associations. And we have a hashtag campaign every year, so people post their prints with the hashtags of whatever sponsors they're interested in. And then at the end of Print Day in May, our sponsors sort through all these prints via the hashtags and then award prizes to the pieces that they select. So it allows us increased viewership and participation, and for them, they also it's a win-win, because printmakers on both the consumer side and the creation side meet each other through our hashtags.
So the sponsors don't pay you, but they come up with prizes for and
exactly interest. There's no money that is involved in Print Day in May at all, which is one of the things that in the world today, which is so increasingly commodified and transactional, that there is nothing about Print Day in May that is like that. It is simply something that people do for the love of print, for the love of creativity, and the love of community.
So we're talking with Robin Smith. That's spelled R-O-B-Y-N-N-S-M-I-T-H, and there's a website, robinsmith.com, with some of her beautiful work. And also you have a Print Day in May website, which is printdayinmay.com, and that's where people would register if they want to participate in Print Day in May, if they want to.
Yes, absolutely. Go to printdayinmay.com, click on registration. It's very easy. It's free. And by registering, you really help us to keep track of how many people are participating, where in the world they are participating from, and you get access to our newsletters, and we never solicit for money or anything like that. So it's a win-win for everybody if you do register.
Well, Robin Smith, have a great trip to New Zealand, and thank you for being with us on From the Bookshelf. We'll talk to you again soon, I hope.
Thanks so much.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program, and we'll come back and see us again next time. I'm Gary Shapiro. Take care. See you soon.